This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Pope Benedict XVI's weekly prayer turned into a massive show of solidarity on Sunday. Tens of thousands of Catholic faithful overflowed St. Peter's Square in support of the pontiff and the church that's still reeling from ongoing developments in the worldwide clergy sexual abuse scandal.
Il vero nemico da temere e da combattere è il peccato. Il male spirituale che a volte purtroppo contagia anche i membri della Chiesa.
The abuse was born of sins within the church that must be purified, the Pope said, which must have sounded both obvious and perhaps hypocritical to church observers right here, because in a U.S. district court today, the Vatican is also expected to make the legal argument that it's not responsible for the actions of its bishops because they're not direct employees of the Holy See and aren't controlled, the Vatican says, on a day-to-day basis by the Pope. But our guest today argues that the Vatican practices an extreme and intimate form of control over Catholic priests, and it does so by requiring them to be celibate. We'll talk to the writer James Carroll in a moment about that. But first, right here in Boston today, breaking news where the Vatican has rejected final appeals by 10 parishes closed by the Archdiocese of Boston in the wake of the clergy sexual abuse scandal. Here with the latest is WBUR's Monica Brady-Meyeroff. Hi, Monica.
Hi, Meghna.
So what does this all mean? What's happened today?
Well, it wasn't a surprise, but if you recall, in 2004, the Archdiocese of Boston shut down dozens of churches. 66 parishes were closed or consolidated, and about 10 of them filed an appeal directly to the Vatican, and it's taken years to get through this process. And of those 10, three went into vigil and locked themselves inside the church and said, we're not leaving. This is our property, and we're going to argue this in the Vatican court that we own this building, we own this parish, and let's see what you say about that. Well, finally, it's come out. The Vatican has said, no, you don't own the property. The Archdiocese of Boston does. And that's the end of their recourse in the Vatican, in the Vatican courts.
So the Archdiocese, if we just remember correctly here, never claimed that it was closing these parishes in response to the sexual abuse crisis directly, but it came right on the heels of the 2002 revelations.
That's right. It came right on the heels of them paying millions of dollars in settlements. But they cited falling attendance, a priest shortage, financial problems. All of these are very real problems for the Archdiocese, but many, many parishioners felt as if the driving force was the clergy sexual abuse scandal. They felt abused again by this seizure of their church. And as I said, three of them that filed appeals have been occupying their church for 5 years now. Another two have also been in vigil. And those who've been in vigil say they're not surprised by this response. They really didn't expect to find a sympathetic ear with the Vatican. But they're considering their next moves. And maybe now we can bring into the conversation one of these people I met back in December, John Rogers. He and his wife, Mary Ellen, have been running the vigil at St. Francis Cabrini in Scituate for the past 5 years. And John, are you there? Because I'd like to ask you, what's your reaction to this?
I am here, and thanks for having us on. Bottom line is that there's no surprise here, and we're not really overly concerned. Really, the next approach will be kind of three-pronged. Obviously, the vigil will continue. Secondly, there's another process that we can go through, and if you would, an appeals process that says that we do not believe they can relegate our church to the profane, which means to use it for our church for non-religious form in any way. So we're going to basically file a letter of intent, send it off to the cardinal, and let him know that we will be filing through our advocate in Rome to let them know that we are going to protest using their rules and regulations that the church be used for anything but religious purposes. So, in essence, there isn't. We believe that there is another avenue of approach here. Now, as far as basically the denial today, once again, no surprise. The vigil will continue. We will explore the next avenue through our advocate in Rome, and finally, we are at this point working on another civil court suit, and that remains to be seen if it's on an individual basis or on a class action suit. So we're not giving up the fight. The people of St. Francis built this church. They bought it. They paid for it. And today they work hard to maintain it. But I will tell you this. Our invitation remains open to Cardinal O'Malley to come to the table and discuss anything, except for the closure of St. Francis, and that includes the people of St. Francis buying back their church, in essence, paying for it twice.
You know, so John, I hear your passion there. You're not giving up the fight. The vigil will continue. You know, we haven't had any response from our calls to the Boston Archdiocese yet to hear what they may do next. But when at last reporting the story, they were waiting for this Vatican appeal to go through the regular course of action before they made their next move. Are you concerned they could take action to lock you out or forcibly remove you from the church?
I think that's a real possibility. And I think that that is a possibility that we are prepared for, and you know what, the responsibility for that would lie squarely on the shoulders of the Archdiocese. You know, I feel bad for instance, if they take the local authorities and have them forcibly remove us, because you're going to have you may have a situation where family members are arresting family members, mm-hmm. and you know for that to happen is literally just a sad event, and that responsibility would lie squarely on the shoulders of the Archdiocese and Cardinal Sean O'Malley.
John, this is Meghna Chakrabarty here again. Just a quick question before we have to let you go.
Sure.
You said that you might be able to raise enough money to buy back the parish. Is that a true possibility? You have that much support there at St. Francis Cabrini?
We once again, that opportunity is to sit across the table from the Cardinal or anybody in the Archdiocese who is in the who has the ability to negotiate that deal, we would welcome an opportunity to sit down and say, okay, this is what do you need, this is what we have, what do we need to raise, sell this parish back to its rightful owners, which is the parishioners of St. Francis Cabrini, or open us up as a fully functioning parish. That invitation has been on the table for years now. I wish somebody would accept it. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Bottom line is they're in a financial crisis. They need the money. We want the church. Mm-hmm. Let's get together and put this deal together.
Well, that's
Let's do it quick.
That's John Rogers. He's continuing the vigil at St. Francis Cabrini in Scituate. John, thank you so much for being with us.
Welcome.
Monica Brady-Meyer, I have one last question to you. So John Rogers mentioned the possibility of some sort of class action suit, possibly a federal suit. Have you heard anything from the Council of Parishes here who are trying to work with these closed churches?
Yeah, they are talking about the possibility of a federal civil lawsuit, but it's just not an easy thing to do. Our federal civil courts have wanted to stay far away from any sort of church meddling in any church doings. So that route seems very unlikely, and now that the Vatican route is closed to them, it does lead me to wonder, this is now a true standoff, what happens next?
WBUR's Monica Brady-Meyerov, always following the latest on the clergy sexual abuse crisis here in the Boston area. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, so that's the latest here in Boston in terms of the ongoing ramifications of what the clergy sexual abuse crisis has unleashed across the Catholic world. But many Catholic thinkers are trying to also think, what went wrong? What got the church to this place? What's part of the underlying structure of modern Catholicism that could have let all this happen? Well, today we're going to speak with the writer James Carroll. And over the weekend in the Boston Globe for his weekly column, in his column, he said, quote, "Lies, denial, arrogance, selfishness, and cowardice prevail in the priestly structure of the Catholic Church, and that's because of enforced priestly celibacy." Do you agree? Is priestly celibacy the pillar propping up unholy aspects of the Catholic Church? Is it one of the causes of the clergy sexual abuse crisis? Or would priestly orders lose their fundamental meaning without the requirement of celibacy? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Well, joining us now in the studio is James Carroll. He's author of a number of award-winning books, including Constantine's Sword and Practicing Catholic. He's also a columnist for The Globe, as I mentioned, and his article, Celibacy and the Catholic Priest, appeared in The Globe this weekend. James Carroll, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's truly wonderful to have you. Let me just start by asking you, you know, in your article this weekend, you referenced something that Pope Paul VI wrote in the late 60s. He called celibacy the church's, quote, brilliant jewel. But you call that the deceit that has corrupted the Catholic soul. Why?
Well, let me broaden the discussion a little bit by saying that celibacy, cited my analogy, is a pillar of the problematic culture. So the first thing I'm saying is not that celibacy is the issue, but the culture of clericalism is the issue, which in, includes a number of notes. One, authoritarian power. It's actually an aspect of what you've already been discussing. An authoritarian power structure with the Pope presiding at the top of it. Think of it as a pyramid. The Pope at the top, cardinals, bishops, priests arrayed down the sides of that pyramid. At the very bottom of it, carrying the weight of it, are lay people who basically have no power mm-hmm. in the church. The culture of power is the issue. And the all-male celibate character of the priesthood is the defining note of that culture of power. And the priestly sex abuse scandal, which showed the power structure protecting the abusers instead of the abused, is the epiphany that lays bare the character of this structure. That's where the lies, the deceit, the corruption, the cowardice come in. Mm-hmm. It was lying, it was deceiving, it was corrupt, it was cowardly of the bishops almost universally to protect the predators instead of protecting the children.
But when it comes to this pillar of celibacy within the structure, within the clerical structure, what really kind of stopped me in my tracks when I read what you wrote this weekend was that in terms of how it demonstrates this culture of power and control is because, as you say, it's a form of power and control over the most intimate aspects, the most personal aspects of the self of a priest.
It's true. It's a mechanism of control over the interior life of priests. It works this way. And recall, as I explained in that article, that I myself was a committed celibate for more than a decade in my youth as a seminarian, as a priest. And so I know about it. The idea was, certainly what I was initiated into, was that God effectively sets aside certain special people to be God's chosen servants. Mm-hmm. God is intimate with these people. There's a kind of spousal relationship, if you will, the kind of intimate commitment that spouses make to one another. A celibate religious person, I would include sisters or nuns in this, makes to God. The whole system depended on the idea that celibacy was willed by God. And during the Revolutionary Council of the Second Vatican Council during the 1960s, what became clear to people was, well, for one thing, history doesn't support that. God didn't will celibacy for the first 1,000 years of the church. Jesus chose married men to be his apostles. God had no commitment to the celibacy of St. Peter or of St. Paul. So the first idea began to crumble right before our eyes. This wasn't willed by God. What then? Well, it was actually chosen by the church in the 12th century at the Lateran Council. The church imposed celibacy on the Latin priesthood as a way of, number one, controlling inheritance of church property, and number two, of reforming the licentious behavior of priests. Mm-hmm. But in order for people to accept such a radical way of life, you can't do it for the sake of church property.
Some sort of theological
reason. You need a transcendent purpose. And the transcendent purpose came to be understood as a way of being intimate with God. And it was when that transcendent purpose was, in effect, left behind by the debates over this question that took place publicly in the church, even at the council, it was then that people, well, like myself, thousands, tens of thousands of priests left the priesthood once it became clear that it was actually the power structure of the church that was being protected, not a relationship with God.
Well, there's much more to talk about regarding this issue. We are talking with James Carroll about celibacy in the Catholic Church, in the Catholic clergy. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll take your calls when we get back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about celibacy and the Catholic Church, and specifically the requirement of celibacy amongst Catholic priests. We're speaking with the writer James Carroll. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. James Carroll, before the break, you mentioned that in the 12th century, in the Second Lateran Council, that was basically when the requirement of celibacy was made an official part of what it meant to be, or what it continues to mean to be a Catholic priest. And that was the moment where a theological meaning was driven into what was previously possibly a practical consideration amongst the church. Now, I don't necessarily want to play dueling biblical quotes, but in reading about this today and thinking more about it, there are those who disagree with you who would say while there's no requirement for celibacy in the New Testament, mm-hmm. no explicit requirement, that there are some places where theological reasoning is given for it. For example, in 1 Corinthians, there's this biblical quote that says, "For he who is without a wife is solicitous for the things that belong to the Lord, how he may please God. But he that is with a wife is solicitous for the things of this world, and he is divided." And so not having a priest's attention divided between his family and his flock, for example, is a reason that people often give for the continuing requirement of celibacy.
Well, that's true, actually. One heard that a lot in my youth, and that quote of St. Paul's is an important part of the rationale for celibacy. The priest is theoretically available to the world, to the people, in ways that married people can't be. The largest problem with that, of course, is the practical experience of Catholics and Catholic priests suggests that isn't so. Catholic priests live in a very protected culture, try to get to a Catholic priest without an appointment. The Catholic priests are harried professionals in our time, and the idea that they are somehow more available to the people that they're serving than, for example, married Protestant ministers or married Jewish rabbis doesn't hold up. You look at the lives of married Protestant ministers and married Jewish rabbis, and I would say married imams, and they are radically available to their congregations. So that practical defense of celibacy really doesn't stand the test. The second point to make is that St. Paul, who is always cited as the great justifier, the requirer of celibacy, the unmarried state is a better way, Paul seems to argue. Mm-hmm. It's crucial that we hear the words of Paul in the historical context. Remember, he wrote 2 Corinthians in the 60s of the first century. He died around the year 66. Jesus died around the year 30. Remember that Paul fully expected the imminent return of Jesus. Jesus was the Messiah who had established the end of time. Mm. And the end of time meant that history was soon to end. You read the letters of Paul, and they're shot through with the idea that history is going to end, if not in my lifetime, in yours. You're not going to be here. We're not going to be here. The world is coming to its fulfillment now, next year. A decade from now, he was an apocalypticist. Guess what? If you're an apocalypticist, the traditional idea of marriage no longer applies. You don't have to keep the future of the human race going. You don't have to have children onward indefinitely into the future. The end time is now. Therefore, procreation is no longer a matter of human survival. So understanding Paul's world and worldview is crucial to understanding what he meant by the call to the preferred life of not getting married.
Hmm. Well, there are so many people who have a lot to say about this topic. Let's turn right to them. Elizabeth is calling from Waltham. Welcome to Radio Boston, Elizabeth.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for taking my call. I lived in a convent for 4 years, and I am so delighted to hear that James is talking about this, and so glad to hear someone saying that enforced celibacy is a problem. I, of course, was living under enforced celibacy as along with 60 other women, and there was so much unhealthy thinking around and talking around sexuality, because there was a sense that if we were meant to be celibate, we shouldn't even be thinking about sexuality. And I think that kind of forcing down of any sexual thought automatically creates neurosis, creates an obsession on some unhealthy level.
Mm. And Elizabeth, I mean, is that something that you yourself struggled with when you were in the convent?
Sure. I mean, I don't want to go into too much detail about it, but as, you know, just in my head, there was definitely a sense that, oh, I shouldn't be thinking about anything sexual. And of course, you know, we're sexual beings. So anytime a sexual thought came in, it was a source of tremendous guilt and discomfort. Mm. And, you know, there was nothing healthy and normal about it.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for your call. James Carroll, you touched on this as well, that this sublimation of a natural desire leads to problems.
Well, it does. Although I don't want to be understood as defining sexual activity as the only human value. There are plenty of examples down through the ages and right into our own time of people who live perfectly well-adjusted, mature, generous lives without overt sexual expression. Most obviously, the monastic tradition. The monastic tradition, which continues to flourish in our time, is a good example of a culture in which the tradition of celibacy, although within the tradition of the monastic vows, it's referred to as chastity. The vows of chastity, poverty, and obedience create a world within which intimate community, intimate human interaction is part of life, even if it isn't sexual. The call to the religious or monastic vocation is different than the call to ordained ministry. What Elizabeth is reminding us of is, even so, we are all sexual beings. And the repression of sexuality, the definition of sexual experience or impulse as somehow evil, is at the core of the problem of the clerical culture today. Here's a small but very important example of it. The Catholic Church demonizes homosexuality, says as a matter of doctrine that homosexuality is a disordered state of being. And yet Catholic priests live in a world from which women have been banished. They live in what I call a homophilic world, a world of all-male culture. And the tensions in that contradiction have led to some very dysfunctional responses. And it's in that you see the generation of what leads to the exploitation of the available and the vulnerable. By some few priests, that has included boys, pre-adolescent or adolescent boys. But the problem largely is that as a mode of control of interior lives, the hierarchy is continuing to impose celibacy on priests, and it inevitably puts many priests, if not all, and I wouldn't say all, in a position of bad faith. Bad faith because any sexual, overt sexual experience is in some way a violation of this cultural compact that the clerical state requires.
Mm. Let's bring in another voice in here for just a moment. She's Joanne Pierce. She's an associate professor of religious studies at the College of the Holy Cross. She's got a somewhat different take on priestly celibacy. Joanne Pierce, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you. Let me just ask you, do you agree with James Carroll's assertion that celibacy is a form of Vatican-based control over the inner lives of the priesthood?
Well, my specialty is medieval, so I do understand a lot of the legal implications for forbidding priests to marry. But actually, I would question some of the presuppositions about considering celibacy simply as a matter of control. I wonder whether, for example, unlike the 50s maybe or the 40s, whether perhaps environmental concerns and environmental theological issues might give another perspective on celibacy, that one treads lightly through the world, if you want to put it that way. There are people who are called, in my belief, and I think in Catholic belief too, to lead lives of celibacy, who are not called to engage in open sexual activity in public in publicly affirmed relationships.
So Joanne Pierce, just to clarify here.
Sure.
So you see celibacy as part of this, the act of celibacy as basically the act of surrender to the total requirements of this greater calling.
Yes, absolutely.
And that you could not answer that call without such a surrender.
Well, I would nuance that, that I think what a couple of the one of the things that takes place within Roman Catholic tradition is that everything having to do with ministry, and that's been changed a little bit since the Second Vatican Council, everything gets centralized into the person of the priest. I think that before we start looking at various pillars or tradition of the priesthood, it's important to take a look at what really is essential or core to the ministry of the priesthood itself, and in what ways can ministerial activity within the church be diffused from that. In other words, one of my suggestions would be that gender equity is also a way of diffusing that kind of power manipulation involved with celibacy.
Mm-hmm.
So look at, for example, the reactivation of the diaconate, which has been in many parts of the United States really quite unsuccessful because people don't really know what to do with these married deacons. If you take a look at the sacramental and pastoral ministry of priests, if we took diaconate seriously, and if we looked at the tradition of diaconate, that would be a way of opening up ministerial activity to married men and married women, that would a ministry that would have to be clearly defined and that would have to be taken seriously and that perhaps could be amplified based on the history of the sacraments themselves.
Mm-hmm. Professor Pierce, hey, stand by for just a second.
Yes.
Just to clarify those who may not know, the diaconate or lay leaders within the church. And let me just get a response from James Carroll here.
Well, I appreciate the notes that Professor Pierce is striking, thoughtful notes. Let me pick up a couple of them. One, the ministry in the church, of course, is not just limited to the priest. Some of the most powerful acts of ministry for centuries have been carried out by sisters. It's the sacramental ministry of the church that has been effectively corralled within the male priesthood. I think that Professor Pierce's note about gender equality is exactly right. I don't believe that we can achieve gender equality through the diaconate. I think that the reviving of the diaconate hasn't gone well because people have seen it for what it is. It's an attempt to skirt around the edge of a real reform of the all-male priesthood. And the second point I would make is that as for the priesthood being a kind of the celibate priesthood being essential to what the priesthood needs to be, the Vatican and the hierarchy itself undercut that when it admitted the great exception of married Episcopal clergy entering the Catholic priesthood as married people, as married men, exactly as a way of Catholic affirming of the conservative impulses of the Episcopal Church. So the Vatican itself is sending a very mixed signal here, and the signals all read, in my view, about issues of control and power.
Joanne Pierce at the College of the Holy Cross, we've got to let you go here in just a second.
Sure.
But as James Carroll pointed out, I mean, the Vatican is obviously central to all this. Do you see any possibility of any, you know, discussion a la what the Second Vatican Council was supposed to have achieved in the 60s under the current pontificate, under Pope Benedict XVI?
Well, it's interesting to note that the Vatican Secretary of State made a kind of an offhand comment at the beginning of the month about celibacy, I forget the exact wording, not being entirely closed. Obviously, celibacy is not indispensable because we see Eastern Catholics, the entire Byzantine tradition, and as has been correctly pointed out, the welcoming of conservative Anglicans. But it has been an important characteristic of priestly ministry, certainly for at least 1,000 years, and it has been intertwined since really the 4th century, even a little bit into the 3rd century. Bishops, for example, were ordained as married, but once they were ordained, they were expected to remain continent within their marriage bond.
So continent meaning not sexually active.
No sexual activity with the wife, mm-hmm, after the man has been ordained bishop. So clearly, I think that celibacy, that there are few people who are called to celibacy. And those who are called to priesthood, who are called to celibacy, should be still encouraged to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
But of course there are the other options, as I just noted, as well.
Well, Professor Pierce, I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut you off there because we've got a lot of folks who also want to join us on the line.
Fine.
But that's Professor Joanne Pierce. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, you're welcome.
She's Associate Professor of Religious Studies at the College of the Holy Cross. Let's sneak in one more call here. Richard's calling from Lowell. Welcome to Radio Boston, Richard.
Thank you, Migna. I'm a Catholic priest also and a religious. And one of the things that I've often thought about in terms of mandatory celibacy, one of the things that is would be a problem in undoing it, if you will, is to face the regret that thousands of men would have to face in their lives who would have married if they could. And I just don't know if the church is ready to deal with that. If you think about thousands of men, maybe in their 60s and 70s, who, you know, that part of their life is gone, and they could never retrieve it. And I think there's a regret there, almost a fear of that people are trying to avoid.
Mm. Richard, thanks so much for your call. James Carroll, let me just add a little something to what Richard asked and turn it back to you. My understanding of the Vatican and the structure of the Catholic Church is that the Vatican is basically the terrestrial administrator of the will of God. So how can it be that anything that the Vatican does is not interpreted as an act of power, as an act of trying to direct the power of God amongst the Catholic faithful?
Well, it's a really good question. But before I address it, I'd like to acknowledge the pain that Richard properly acknowledged is involved in the changes that we're talking about here. And there would be equivalent pain for lay people who would be told if the church changed its position on birth control that they made tremendous sacrifices through their adult lives in ways that now the church is walking away from. So that's an important note and humane note to have in mind here. I nevertheless advocate for change in both fronts. But as for the Vatican being in some way a kind of special emblem of God's presence in the world, that's a claim that I would not make as a Catholic. And in fact, I would say that is a symptom of the present Catholic problem. That's the problem of the clerical culture that puts everything on the clergy, the clerical system, the hierarchy, the Pope and the bishops. The Christian tradition from the New Testament is that the Christian community is a symbol and sign of God's presence in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the priests, bishops, cardinals, and popes are servants of that community. They are not power sent. This is not an American corporation. The Pope is not a CEO. The Pope is the servant of the servants of God. He is the first among equals of the bishops who meet together collegially responsible for the teaching authority of the church. They share that authority with the priests and the laity. It is not an up-down, over-under authority system, or it's not intended to be. This is all that the Second Vatican Council was attempting to do when it stopped talking about the church as the perfect society and began talking about it as the people of God.
And yet today, even in this news here in Boston about the Vatican ruling that the Archdiocese can close these parishes down, I think we're still seeing that fundamental tension between where is the true power center of the church. And I would love to have you back on Radio Boston to delve more into that in sometime in the future, James Carroll.
Anytime. Thanks so much.
That's the writer James Carroll. His latest book is Practicing Catholic. He also had a terrific article in the Boston Globe this weekend about celibacy and the Catholic Church.